Accession number 4662, ring number 2.
Anderson Reel 2. Mr. Anderson, you were describing your flying training itself in England.
Yes, that's quite correct. We had to do a certain amount of flying from the wireless training school, and this was done in Bristol fighters stationed at Worthydown, a flying station just nearby us, where they flew night fighters, Vickers Virginias, and the small detachment of Bristol fighters. Anyway, it was quite an exciting thought of going flying. Anyway, we went across there, a small party of would-be wireless operators, and here we were introduced to the aeroplane and the sets we had to use. Well, we knew the sets already, and we were given the wavelength we had to tune into. When we got airborne, and call up the station, pick it up, reply to a message, or send an exercise message, or receive one. So that was our instructions, and of course we were far more keen thinking about flying rather than our wireless exercise. Anyway, one put on a fighting harness. Parachutes weren't carried in those days in those aircraft. You hook yourself to the floor, stop oneself from being bounced out of the aircraft. And so I sort of held myself in great excitement, waiting for takeoff. The aircraft taxied out, of course, over grass, bouncing about a bit. And as the engine opened up, I could feel the wind, the slipstream blowing into my face. And the noise, I thought, Lord, I'd never be able to hear Morse code through all this noise. That's my first thought as we took off. Anyway, another impression was the cold air striking my face as the engine was opened up. Anyway, we got airborne, and I saw the ground quite rapidly to me, of course, receding away. It's quite a thrill in a way. It's quite exciting rather than a thrill. The new experience entirely. Anyway, then of course my mind went back to my duties. Unreel the aerial, which consisted of 250 feet of copper wire with a 4.5 pound lead weight on the end, on the end of a reel. Just let that go out on its own, and gradually put the brake on towards the end. Stop it, couldn't have a sudden jerk, otherwise the wire live the brake and you lose your 4.5 pound weight, which would drop on somebody's roof or on their head, which wouldn't be very pleasant. So be careful towards the last few feet to stop the speed of it going out, and then set my transmitter to the required wavelength. But while doing this, I keep having a peek over the side, see what I could see, but strange to say, visibility wasn't great once you got in the air. You couldn't see very far, due probably to a haze and slight mist. You only could see directly down the ground, directly beneath one. It was like a small map straight down below. You had no horizontal visibility at all, which quite surprised me. I thought, well, it's got airborne, you see for a long way. But that was my first flying experience. And the sensation of flying was just this noise and a bit of wind on the face you sat up in the cockpit, but had it put your head down below the gun ring near the set, so it wouldn't be out of the slipstream, so I have a chance of picking up your Morse code signals. Anyway, I tuned in my transmitter, called up the ground, and heard their reply, because I also set the receiver. You had a wave meter in the aeroplane as well, which was separate from the set. You just held in front of the set, which was sort of a mini transmitter, and you just tuned your set into whatever wavelength the wave meter was making, and tune that in. And of course, it wants slight adjustment one side of the tuning dial to pick up the ground station. Would be calling back, and then you'd answer them, receive the message, have a writing pad to write it down, and reply. Probably the flight, I don't know how long it took, at the very most half an hour, I think. And we came down again. We had to wind the aerial in. Takes quite some time to reel in 250 feet of copper wire on a reel. Anyway, that was done, then came in. When it was all over, you didn't quite realise what had happened. You'd been flying. You were so busy, and but only had quick looks over the side. But you felt that, well, I have achieve a little bit of my long thought ambition of flying, being associated with aircraft. And also this association with aircraft, which also began during training in two places. It's going back a little bit again, even at the Uxbridge station, they had a Sopwith Snipe in the MT yard, fully braced and with engine, with a Bentley rotary engine in it. And it's there, and also a Bristol Fighter chassis, a fuselage, I'm getting the correct names of these things, fuselage with an engine, Rolls-Royce Falcon engine. And on these aircraft, on the Snipe in particular, we were taught the difference between flying wires and landing wires. Dope was used for stretching the canvas or the cotton fabric covering of the aeroplane, and lecture on the rotary engine, and general airmanship, the names of the places of the aerolons, the names of the aerolons, what they did, the tailplane, the elevators, the rudder. So we became acquainted with the various parts of the aeroplane and the fuselage. And then, if we were lucky, we took part in practice swings. Didn't start the engine, just swung the propeller of a Bristol Fighter. There were three men, one holding the prop, and other two men holding hands. You know, one, two, three, pull, and just run against the compression, get the engine on compression, and pull away. And as you pull away, mechanically starting the aircraft, would turn the hand magneto, get the spark. So as you turned over compression, you get a spark. And the engine should fire, according to theory, but sometimes it took quite a number of pulls. Anyway, that was a first acquaintance with close contact with aeroplanes. And then again, during the course, we had to wire up sets inside aeroplanes, and had to wire them up. We weren't told how to wire them up. We knew the connections had to be made, but we were left our own devices, which routes the wires took to connect a transmitter and a wireless receiver in usually old Bristol Fighter, the old wooden cockpits. And we left our own devices, and when you finished, the inspecting officer would come round, examine your work, and either make fun of it, you made a mess, or praise you, which is rare indeed, that you've done a good work. But you left entirely to your own devices, which found later on in actual service life, there was no laid down routes of wires, but one got so used to it, the best routes to put them in. And as a part of our training, and also dealing with the aircraft again, which is very interesting. Now that was our flying. Then, of course, I went to Gosport, did my normal duties there of a station wireless operator. Then I got my notice for overseas posting. And from there, I had to wait for my tropical kit to come into stock. They had to order it specially when going overseas. I didn't keep a stock in stores. And I was getting anxious and more anxious. It didn't turn up because I wanted my 28 days overseas leave. They wouldn't let you go on leave till your tropical uniform had arrived. And eventually it did arrive, and I was allowed to go on my 28 days, which I only just managed, 28 days leave to home. And I had my 28 days leave, and my parents, or my father, was actually serving in Ireland by this time, in Belfast. And my mother was in Dover, from where I had enlisted. Their mothers didn't say anything because she's a service. She'd been brought up in the service as a girl. Her father had been in the army. She used to break up her family. Family was going overseas. She said nothing, but I knew she was a little upset at the thought of going to India, because India wasn't probably a very pleasant place. My father was there. My grandfather died of cholera in the Second Afghan War in India. And so they thought, what am I going to do in India? So anyway, I said goodbye to my mother. I didn't see my father because he was in Ireland. And I left then, because it was a long tour. One did 5 years overseas then. I'd be away from home for 5 years. But I was quite excited at the thought of India. I'd already had sort of pictures in my mind what India would be like. And I always imagined one place in India that's extraordinary would be a sloping path going up amongst hills with trees either side. And that exactly turned out as our hill depot, away from the plains, the hot plains and the barren plains. That's such a contrast, but that's a picture I thought of India. I don't know why I had that picture. It must be from some story I read, I don't know. But it's exactly as I had had imagined that part, because that's only a very short part. Anyway, I was quite pleased. I had no objection to overseas service. I didn't mind leaving home because, well, I was a serviceman now, and service was my life, and that's being more or less, in a way, dedicated. I had a family background of service, and this was just part of the service life. So I wasn't upset about leaving home. I'm sorry to leave my mother, of course, but I was looking forward to some new life, new place to see. I'd been to Egypt as a boy. A number of times I'd been to Hong Kong as a boy with my father in service. So India was a new place. That was exciting. So I got on a troop ship. I also travelled on troop ships before with my father, but usually, of course, as a passenger. But this time I was travelling as a troop in a troop ship. and of course, I got to Southampton and boarded the Navassa troop ship. And we allotted to our place, our mess decks. And that's all we were allotted. And I went down to my mess deck and found it was the very lowest, about the fourth deck lower, the lowest one just above the bilge, I think. Our portholes only could be open. The only time we had them open was going through the Suez Canal. They were just about 2 feet above the water, so they were closed normally. Very down bottom of the ship, so the only ventilation was when it was permitted, when it wasn't raining or stormy, was wind chutes, a big barrel of canvas going all up the gangways, which went down the stairs that went down, wooden stairs, like a big chute. And these had big wings on them that scooped the air as the ship went travelled forward. And that got the only sort of air one got down below. The rest, of course, all potholes, no electrical ventilation like that in those days. Just by a little bit of fresh air with a bit of luck for the thing. Anyway, I found out that there's only just one mess deck of Air Force. They're all BIOS operators, 21 of us all told. And I don't know how many troops, a few hundred troops, actually packed full of troops. And the mess decks, when you went down to them, they probably read messing 150, sleeping 100. But there wasn't sleeping accommodation, the other 50. They had to find out some sleeping place themselves. That meant on the floor, on the tables, or any cubbyhole on the deck, wherever you could find place to sleep. There's only enough place for slinging your hammocks. I travelled in hammocks then. Enough hooks for the 100 men, about one third of the complement of the ship, could sling their hammocks. Anyway, first night out, it was very, very rough indeed. This was in February 1929 when we left and got in the channel. Snow, blizzard snow was swirling around. Hail was coming down, the ship was dipping. Luckily, I was a very good sailor. I've spent so much time on small boats playing around in the water. It didn't worry me in the slightest how rough it was. And I enjoyed it being on deck looking at the storm. And then I thought, well, it's about time. I think they blew lights out. Or I think they still did the army routine on board ship, but the lights never went out. They still kept full blare all night. Anyway, I thought it was about time I went down to sleep. So I went down, got my hammock. Of course, I couldn't find any way to hook them up. And of course, all the mess deck was actually smothered in all the soldiers and probably our airmen as well, being sick. Oh, they're all terribly seasick. I thought, well, the only place to go would be safe would be under the mess table, long tables hung by chains from the roof. And, I call them the roof or the ceiling or the deck above on the ship. And I got underneath this, I thought I'd be safer there. And I didn't undress, I just rolled up my boots in my grey coat for a pillow and rolled out the canvas hammock, and that was my bed for the night. At least I thought that was my bed for the night, but it wasn't long before I saw streams of seasickness sort of spewed, to be very vulgar, coming towards me. And I thought, well, there's no place for me. I'll be saturated in the morning. So I rolled up my hammock and put my greatcoat on, my boots on again, clambered up the deck and tried to find a sheltered spot in the snowstorm, which I eventually found under a donkey engine. And it smelt a bit oily underneath there, but it seemed fairly clean on the ground. So I didn't even take off my boots off this time and kept my greatcoat on. I think we had one blanket with the hammock, just put this blanket round me, and I slept quite soundly. I was tired after a day's travelling and getting a little bit late, but that was my first night at sea under a donkey engine in a snowstorm. But again, I don't know, it was something about my makeup that didn't upset me, and I didn't think it was a hardship. So I carried on. Also, I was detailed to be mess orderly, collect the meals from the cookhouse for our table of mess RVM. But we decided amongst ourselves we we'd divide it up or share it and do 3 days at a time, because it meant getting the meals, doing all the washing up of the plates, and after you've finished, to scrub the table and scrub your floor area, ready for the morning inspection, finished by 11 o'clock. It was quite a lot of hard work, and you had to polish all your tea urns and your Dixies with metal polish so they shone after the meal. It's quite a lot of hard work being mess orderly. But the soldiers were quite good. I like the soldiers very much, because I have my sympathies with soldiers. And some of them a bit rough, but they were all good-hearted men, really. And they saw the RAF getting a bit behind, because they thought of us as not exactly the queenies of the service, or the Nancy boys. They thought we were a little above the rest, especially while us operated the clean hand brigade, putting our hands mucky or covered in grease and such like. But we were quite good friends, and a little bit of late bullying went on. But if they saw we were getting behind, when they're scrubbing their floors, they come over to our side a little bit more on both sides. So we only have probably a small strip to scrub. And they probably said, oh, give us one of your cans of polish, they've finished soon. They were very good. And they got on very well down below decks with them. And also, I like the soldiers, talking to them, because they knew their regimental history so well. If they weren't well educated, their history of the regiment really drummed into them. Almost brainwashing, I should imagine, is a modern term. But then, it was pride of regiment. And they knew their regiment, their battle honours and such like, their flag, the battle flag, or their ensign, as it's called. And they knew all the history from the beginning of their regiment's life. And they're quite interesting to talk to. They would talk about their regiment and the countries they've been to. But we were all, the whole lot were going to India at this particular time. And so the voyage continued. Also on deck, it got more pleasant, of course, after leaving the Bay of Biscay, got to the Mediterranean, the weather got a bit more pleasant. And, of course, everybody tried to sleep on deck then. Then it was a job to find deck space. You just rolled out your canvas. So as soon as they sound a bugle, you would collect hammocks of an evening, so you rush down to your, because unfortunately right down below, you always last up again. Other people get up there first, the soldiers would do, but probably a friend of yours would lie on the deck, on the bed, they can spread themselves as much as possible while you got his hammock and your own hammock, and came up. You had to work in pairs like that, so you have a little bit of deck space to unroll your hammock for the night, which is one slept quite well on the hard boards, just a bit of roll of canvas underneath, and your boots as a pillow. So the voyage went smoothly. We got paid on the voyage, and they had a little canteen on board, where one could buy cigarettes. I smoked in those days, buy cigarettes, chocolate, biscuits, and the toothpaste, and all the small comforts of life like that. And often, long queue, of course, soon as it opened, or before it opened, there'd be a long queue of soldiers and hopeless, and most of the Air Force chaps couldn't be bothered queuing. And we'd probably ask one of the soldiers would volunteer to get our stuff, whatever we wanted, for the And we used to reward them, say, well, buy yourself a packet of woodbines, which cost tuppence in those days for five, and buy yourself a packet of woodbines for your trouble. And they were quite willing, because they got to buy things for themselves. They didn't mind getting it for us Air Force chaps. Probably our pay was just that little bit higher than the Army, though as a skilled wireless operator, as far as I remember, it was about 3 and 6 a day. My pay got 1 and 6 a day, I think, as a skilled wireless operator. But that was, I suppose, with the Army. That was quite good, probably still on their 2 bob a day, I should imagine. If they were fairly young, they wouldn't have any rifle qualifications or any other good service conduct badges and things like that to boost their pay up. So probably their pay was still in the region of 2 shillings a day. Less stoppages, there's always stoppages in pay of some sort or the other, for barrack damages or clothing we've had to buy. And for a pack of cigarettes or tuppence, we'd get our stuff more or less brought to us. It was all good companionship and comradeship on board that ship. It was very good. And it's also we did a little bit of PT every day in the sun, take our jackets off, and we wore our what they call them now, canvas shoes, crepe soles. I've got the official name for them now. Our gymnasium shoes. They were our sort of soft shoes for wearing in the barracks after duty. Took our ammunition boots off. We wore those all day on board ship once we got down to the routine, because you couldn't camber around companionways up and decks with sort of steel-studded boots. So we could do a bit of PT, swing our arms about every day, about 3/4 an hour or so, deep breathing and jumping about. And so we got paid a certain amount on the voyage, all the same amount of money, which was to buy our things. The voyage to India took about 21 days, if I remember correctly. It's going back a long time now. It's 1929. And of course, going through the Suez Canal was quite interesting. We could open our portholes in the absolute smoothness of the Suez Canal, get some fresh air into the mess deck. And of course, I've been through the Suez Canal, I think, quite a few times myself before, so I knew that. But it was always interesting experience going there, down to the Red Sea. I think we called in Aden, we may have recalled there. I just can't remember. And then on to Bombay, where we disembarked, was got dressed up, pushed our gear into our kit bags onto the shore, and there, of course, we just looked around. Then we found a civilian again, European. He was the embarkation and disembarkation officer. He just shouted out, "Royal Air Force," or had a notice up, I can't quite remember. I know we all congregated at this particular point with this man. And I think we may have even stayed on board until we were told to go ashore, ordered to go ashore, and he came on board probably to meet us. I can't quite remember details now. Anyway, we got ashore under the guidance of this embarkation officer, and he had the list names of the airmen on board and our postings in India. Mine was into the Punjab, to the station called Ambala, with I think five or six of us were due to go there. So I think late that afternoon we got into the train. He took us to the station. Various times station people went, got in their respective trains, and off we went across India up to the Punjab. Of course, I didn't realise, or hadn't given much thought, the hugeness of India. But it also is a completely different to my idea. I thought India, tropical country, jungle and tigers and things like that in my ignorance of my youth. But it was very barren. We left the station and all went to very flat country, just sort of bush country, the odd bush and the odd tree here and there. And absolutely flat as far as the eye could see. So I was quite surprised, that type of country, because probably it wasn't a jungle country, I've got a really southern view for that. Well, Bombay is about a little more than towards the south, a little more than nearly halfway, but a little bit more towards the south, very roughly, of course. Anyway, night came, and the compartments in Indian trains, you sat in them during the day, and during the night you pulled the seats out and the tops came down, and you had bunks to sleep in. So we kipped down for the night. Next morning we carried on our journey on and on and on, and it was past midnight or so when we arrived in Ambala. And we got out the train there, and we made inquiries, and don't know whether they telephoned to the camp, but we sat in the railway station a while, and eventually, we call them tenders, we call them a Crossley tender, use Crossleys. Then Crossley tender arrived, so a canvas hooded truck with seats in the back. We got into this, and we arrived and took us to Ambala, to the RAF station, and that was around about 3 o'clock in the morning, the early hours of the morning. And they just dumped us by one of the buildings there. We called bungalows, but they're quite huge buildings for sake of coolness. They were double verandaed, and they dumped us outside, and most of them had the lights showing, because they never turned the lights out, always had the loose swallow lights for any stop or discourage any of these loose swallows. They were the thieves who came in the night. Sometimes they they greased their bodies, so you couldn't catch hold of them. They just slipped away. You try to grab them, but I never experienced them all the time I was in India. I never found anything stolen at all. I think on the whole, the Indians were a very, very honest race. Anyway, we sat on the steps leading up to one of these blocks, huts or bungalows. And then a man came out from inside the bungalow and said, just arrived. They asked who we were and what we were. One of the airmen, and we told him. He said, "Like a cup of tea." And this boy, I never thought he had a cup of tea. Anyway, he was very good. He'd been practically hanging up all night with a session with his pals with a few bottles of beer. He ran his bed, he went across the cookhouse. We're either preparing breakfast or gunfire, probably preparing gunfire. They called it gunfire. We're at the crack of dawn or before dawn, tea and biscuits brought down round to your bed, and that was the sign for waking up and getting ready for work. So one went to work then, before first light, it's still dark when you walked across or marched across the airfield to the technical side, to the hangar and the workshops, etc., for the day's work. So this gunfire probably would be around about 5 o'clock. No, they'd come round, and the barber would come round too at that time in the morning to shave you while you're in bed with a lamp, if you wanted to pay for that luxury. But they're very good. I used to have it sometimes, not always, not in my home station. And anyway, this man, this airman, we got to know him very well later on, quite a terrific character. He managed to get cups of tea and borrowed mugs for us, and we sat on the steps and drank tea, waiting the official start of work in the morning. And this man, he was quite a character. He'd been in the Royal Flying Corps and served on the Royal Air Force, but he had never achieved any rank. He was a rigger by trade, and he drank more than good for his health, really, but he did his work all right. And he'd never achieved any rank because he said he'd passed his army first class educational certificate, which entitled him to leading air craftsman. But the Air Force wouldn't recognize it, or he couldn't produce it. So he never got promoted beyond a first class aircraftman. Yet he was a man who had 3 good conduct badges showing his 13 years service. That was our first introduction to our new camp, because next day we went to the headquarters, booked in, and allotted to our job, some to the main wireless cabin. And I was allotted to one of the aircraft flights in the hangar, as a wireless operator in the hangar.
Umbrella was a one squadron station. Squadron was it?
Yeah, it was 28 Squadron, Army Cooperation Squadron, 28 AC Squadron, and equipped with Bristol fighters. Of course, a 1917 vintage airplane, though this is 1929, because all these services were maintained by the Indian government. And of course, they did things as cheaply as possible, even in England, expenses were rather curtailed at that particular time. In India, it was the same. Everything was paid by the Indian government. They had to maintain us, so they kept everything to a minimum. It wouldn't be most difficult to get new aircraft, it would be practically impossible. And so we carried on with Bristol fighters. But they're quite a good aeroplane, really. They're quite reliable, though very small, and endurance wasn't all that great. Anyway, I was posted to work on these aeroplanes, and of course I had sufficient experience to soon settle into the work of fitting up, because our work was army cooperation. And the sets were the standard sets normally I've been trained on and been taught to use at the training school, but rather different from main wireless station sets. They were just portable ones, and you change these wireless sets in accordance with whatever job one was doing. For instance, if you're doing a long distance reconnaissance or a long flight, you'd use Morse code. That meant a transmitter, appropriate transmitter and receiver, then your Morse code. And of course, you had this long aerial one unreeled, which was sometimes a pilot say, or finish the exercise and give no communication. You had to either shout lean over the cockpit and shout the pilot's ear, or by signs, no tubes or electrical communication. So he'd give a sign, probably waving his arm in a circular motion, which meant wheeling the aerial. So you had to let the ground know you were switching off, that you're wheeling in the aerial, and then start winding this 250 feet in. And of course the pilot would think, or they would, not thinking, they always have plenty of time to do that. And when you come into land, you sort of furiously wind the last 100 feet or so before you actually touch the ground. But many a time, the aircraft have landed, still trailing a part of the aerial, and the lead 4.5 pound weight hits the ground. Of course, then it springs forward, and you sort of see it come over over the front of the aeroplane. And it's come right over the front wing, and just dangling in front of the front wing. It's 4.5 pound weight. It could be quite dangerous if it hit the prop or hit the pilot or the air gunner on the head, swinging around like that. It'd be a terrific wallop. But normally, when it was the pilot would wait. You just gave him a tap on the shoulder and a thumbs up sign, so it was okay to go into land. But that was one of the sort of things one would be prepared for, a real furious rush to get the aerial in. That's another type of set we used was telephony. That was speaking, calling up by ground sets to the ground. That was never very successful. The sets were old, the valves were old. You had a terrific job to find a valve that would oscillate properly. You'd try valve after valve, get probably 20 from these stores, and try one after the other, get the set to oscillate and pick up the signals correctly. But we did manage somehow. And these sets were close cooperation with the army for close reconnaissance. That is, you would fly over the column or the brigade, as the case may be, or their headquarters or their mobile set, and communicate with them by speech. The pilot would do the talking, communicate by speech, and it would be a